Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to start our committee meeting right now. We have a slightly condensed meeting today. The bells will ring at 5:15, and the votes will take place sometime after that. So we're going to have to condense each panel by about 7 minutes to fit everything in. So we'll get right at that. And what I'd also, I think what we should do is to make sure that we get our normal rounds of questions in, we should go from 7 minute questions to 5 minute questions just to make sure everybody gets a chance. We have two people in the first panel here. We'll just get a little order here. We'll just get a little order. Thank you. We have two people here by video conference, Ms. Bray and Ms. Nickel. Can you hear us okay?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Well, seeing how you're here through our technology, we'll have you go first. So, Ms. Bray, you can present first, and then Ms. Nickel, you'll go after Ms. Bray. All right, so go ahead.
Okay, good afternoon. My name is Dr. Rena Bray. I have a degree in chemical engineering and a master's in pharmacology in the area of addictions and toxicology. I studied medicine at the University of Toronto and did a specialty in family practice. I have a master's in health sciences, public health in family and community medicine. I have been medical director of the Environmental Health Clinic at Women's College Hospital and associate professor in the Department of Family and Community Medicine, University of Toronto, since 2002. I was chair of the Environmental Health Committee of the Ontario College of Family Physicians for over 10 years. I have taught university-level courses, lectured widely to the public and peers, mentored and taught hundreds of medical students, done environmental health research, published and created educational materials. I have been investigating electromagnetic fields and human health for the past 10 years. Dear Honorable Chair and members of the committee, thank you for inviting me to speak about my experiences in caring for patients who have developed hypersensitivities from chronically high levels of exposure to electromagnetic fields in everyday life. Since the time of these diagnoses that were initially made 10 years ago, the numbers have increased dramatically, perhaps due to increased awareness and perhaps due to increased unrestrained use of wireless devices. It is difficult to say. Individuals who are sensitive to EMF or those with electromagnetic hypersensitivity are canaries in a coal mine and lucky enough to have discovered what it is that is making them feel unwell. Many of them find everyday life and work difficult and uncomfortable. Most often, we see them with family members who thought the patient had gone mad, but then realized that what they were saying was actually true through observations. We see EHS in people who have predisposing stressors such as cardiac arrhythmias, neurological problems, physical and mental exhaustion, previous prolonged exposures, as with teachers and technicians working in wireless institutions, airline industry, computer and information technology, and health professionals in institutions where wireless technology is used for monitoring. In my opinion, based on what I have seen and read, those at highest risk for EHS include the fetus, children, the elderly, the infirm, those with predisposing morbidities, usually cardiac and neurological, and those with toxic overload. They are all at risk for adverse health effects from this insufficiently regulated, poorly studied, man-made environmental health hazard, the radio and microwaves ranging from 10 kilohertz to 10 to hundreds of gigahertz. People, despite the way they're feeling, have no choice to stop the radiation on their bodies or their children's bodies, but must put faith in the government that there is indisputably no harm being done. Sources causing a majority of problems in patients we have seen include airport technology, cell phone units and towers, cell phones, Wi-Fi routers, Wi-Fi hubs, laptops, iPads, baby monitors, and fluorescent lights. Signs and symptoms include skin irritations, headaches, tinnitus or ringing in the ears, brain fog, listlessness, fatigue, concentration problems, dizziness, low mood, irritability, malaise, heart palpitations, nausea, and gastrointestinal disturbances. We have found that about half have chemical sensitivities. Holter monitors have been helpful in proving that cardiac symptoms can be induced or provoked with increasing levels of exposure, such as being close to cell phone towers or Wi-Fi hubs. EHS is characterized by these signs and symptoms which occur due to prolonged exposures at home, work, or school, and abate when the person has been removed from that environment. Depending on the extent of disability, the symptoms can come on in 1 to 5 minutes and require the patient to take time off work or school in order to recuperate sufficiently. We have noted that it can take up to 1 day to recover, although recovery is sometimes much faster, such as a few minutes, depending on the health of the individual. The question that continues to alarm me is, what of those who have not yet become sensitized or are unwell but have not realized it is the EMFs provoking the problem and continue to try to function in an environment where the electrical and magnetic fields are high? Multiple Wi-Fi hubs, laptops, and cell phones all in one space can reach levels of over 1 million microwatts per meter squared. This has been measured in a high school from the proximity of an adjacent classroom. The electrical field would be greater than 10 to the 7th microwatts per meter squared in that occupied classroom. What are the exposure levels for the students and teachers in a class of that type for hours daily, year after year? Has anyone done a study on that? No. Teachers are forbidden by school boards to make measurements on their own or turn off Wi-Fi hubs that are not even in use, or they will lose their jobs. As a physician who has specialized in the area of environmental health for over 20 years, I am mortified at the lack of accountability regarding radio and microwave radiation use in the everyday lives of Canadians, both young and old. I am appalled by the poor, impractical, unrealistic research done in this area and the lack of proper, relevant investigations that need to be done and have not. There are no longitudinal studies except the one going on right now on people who did not ask to be subjects, who gave no research ethics board consent, and on whom data is not being collected. That is not a study at all. Some of my patients are going to Green Banks, West Virginia, to recuperate. In Green Banks, there is a ban on sources of EMFs that would interfere with the operation of radio telescopes. All of these patients' symptoms abate after a few days, but unfortunately return when they return to their Canadian environments. Diagnosed and properly managed hypersensitive patients get better slowly over 1 to 2 years with the treatment of their current comorbidities, the use of shielding to reduce exposure, and this is at their own expense, the diligent avoidance of environments with high exposures, and proper accommodation at work or school. Questions that need answering include, what are the other physicians in the community finding? Anecdotally, they tell me they are reporting more patient concerns for EMF exposures and noting symptoms related to EMFs, but we need to gather statistics properly. We also need to have a public opinion poll on the matter. The CCHS, the Canadian Community Health Survey, would be useful in that regard. We need to find out how many complaints doctors are actually getting, how many people are out there feeling unwell from something they can't touch, see, smell, or taste. We must protect our citizens properly, and we have to be educated in order to do that. How much are children, including the fetus, being exposed cumulatively on a daily basis, and how much EMF exposure could potentially cause problems in the early years or disease and illness in the latter years? Some physicians are taking some initiatives. For example, the Austrian Medical Society published a report on diagnosis and treatment of patients with EHS and ongoing research examining biomarkers associated with the condition. As a physician, educator, advocate, and healthcare leader, I feel physicians are seriously lacking in the fundamentals of science of EMFs from a physical science, technological, and biological standpoint. They need to become aware of the EMF sources and how the characteristics of this radiation impact on the body. They need to understand the condition of EHS, which affects about 3% of the population severely, and how this condition is related to other coexisting medical conditions. They need to understand the impacts of EMFs on children, issues arising in schools, baby care, and pregnancy. They need to become aware of ways they can help patients protect themselves by minimizing exposures through common sense measures and shielding. The EMF phenomenon has increased in intensity in our society from 10 to the minus 6 microwatts per meter squared, the natural background level of our very recent ancestors, to 10 to the 7th microwatts per meter squared. This is an increase of 10 million million times. This should be alarming. Tobacco, pesticides, lead, mercury, PBA, particulates in air pollution, and a plethora of other environmental health hazards, which have been deemed as having increasingly smaller safe limit thresholds, are a reminder to us that radio and microwave use, which is supposedly regulated and considered safe, is more than likely going to come to a similar unfavorable end. I hope we are not too late. It does not have to be this way if we use technology responsibly. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bray. Ms. Nickel, go ahead.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes,
thank
go
you.
Ahead.
Thank you for inviting me. My name is Anne-Marie Nickel. I am a PhD epidemiologist trained at the University of BC in the Faculty of Medicine. I'm a professor at Simon Fraser University, and I also work at the BC Centers for Disease Control. My usual area of expertise is ionizing radiation. I deal predominantly with radon. However, I was asked to be part of the Royal Society panel as an expert on risk communication and risk perception, which is where I do a majority of my research. So in my capacity in the panel, I was not asked there to be a radiobiologist or a radiation scientist. I was there to help with the public meeting and to understand better the perceptions of the public through the Royal Society process. And so just to speak quickly to the Royal Society process, we were asked to review Safety Code 6. We were given a very clear mandate to evaluate the science, and the Royal Society decided that it would be prudent to provide a day in which we listened to people's perceptions, given that there had been a number of inquiries from the public and different NGOs regarding their desire to speak to the process. So I sat for 9 hours and listened to the testimony from people all day long, both in person and over the internet, about their concerns around Wi-Fi and EMF and RF in general. And then my job was to collate that input, organize it, and provide the information back to the Royal Society. And in doing so, I came up with 4 major areas. The first was major concerns about health impacts and health effects, which Dr. Bray has very eloquently just described. There is also serious concerns about exposure. People are very worried about what they're exposed to. People were very concerned about the Royal Society process and whether or not it was being manipulated or controlled by Health Canada. And there was also a very clear desire for more communication about RF in general. So I'm going to just unpack each of those 4. There were other findings. However, these were the 4 findings overall that we tried to address in the final report for Safety Code 6 from the Royal Society. So regarding health effects, there was incredibly poignant testimony from a number of people who have obviously been impacted by something in their life. I am not a clinician, nor am I a diagnostician, so I cannot tell you what was causing these people's pain, but I can tell you in a very heartfelt way that it was hard to sit and listen to person after person discuss how their life had been significantly impacted. And one of the recommendations that I feel is prudent, that Dr. Bray has also discussed, is that we need a place for people to go and discuss their symptoms or the constellations of symptoms. Here in BC, we have what are called complex chronic disease clinics. I know in Ontario, we have environmental health clinics. I think these are very important places for people to both be treated and to start to collect data for surveillance. As an epidemiologist, I believe it's important that we understand what people are exposed to or their symptoms, so that we can at least come up with an overall sense of what's going on in this country. Currently, that data is not being collected. And in fact, we allow these people to be shunted from one specialist to another, where they get increasingly frustrated and become incredibly vulnerable to non-medical interventions. So I think as a society, we need to be doing a better job of addressing these people who appear to be very seriously impacted by this. On the topic of exposure, it is very clear that most people have very little understanding of what radio frequency actually is. Most people do not realize that this is a question of proximity. They are very concerned about the ubiquity of exposure without an understanding that the closer a technology is to your body, the more dangerous it possibly could be to you. So this is a question of proximity and a question of education. And given the ubiquity of radio frequency in our society, I do find it quite amazing that we are not doing a very good job either in the public school system or in general of discussing what RF actually is. I think one of the more poignant stories, too, was a conversation with someone regarding a baby monitor. People had no idea that baby monitors emitted some kind of radio frequency. They put their baby monitor next to their child, which would be a normal thing that you would want to do with a baby monitor. And then they were very shocked to realize that that was emitting something that could potentially have some impact on their child. And they felt essentially deceived both by the product manufacturer and the government, in part because they don't understand what RF is nor how the technology exists. And I'm sure these people are not alone. And as a result, we are essentially breeding, if you think about risk perception research, we are breeding a whole group of people who are suddenly very distrustful of both the government and the manufacturers for not telling them what's actually in the product and how it emits. If we think about cell phones, it's the same issue. Many, many people were concerned about Wi-Fi, but less concerned about cell phones. And if we look at how much RF is emitted between Wi-Fi and cell phones, it is clear that a cell phone is a major emitter of RF, Wi-Fi much less. Again, this is an issue of proximity. And most people really don't realize that a cell phone, like used like a normal phone, is not the most prudent way of operating that device, that again, distance is important. And there's interesting messaging that's coming out. For example, texting is safer than talking on the phone, and yet we have a whole public health campaigns around not texting during certain activities. So you can see where we're getting very mixed messages to the public, if they understand this even at all, around the technology. So I think we need overall much better information to consumers about what their exposure is, about this issue of distance. It could be done in a number of different modalities, but it is a very important component that is missing in our dialogue with the public around RF. Regarding the process, there was I was brought into the process because my predecessor on the board had to step down due to a conflict or a potential conflict of interest. I did come to the board as an independent academic. We had no involvement from Health Canada, that I can speak to that. So we were not micromanaged by Health Canada in the Safety Code 6 review process at the Royal Society. Although there was a lot of mistrust in the community around that, and you can see it's why that would occur given some of the other factors that have gone around. These are people who have not been heard, people who are potentially suspicious of a process that they have had no potential real dialogue with. And in terms of risk communication overall, people want more education. Perhaps this is labeling on products. Perhaps this is a basic primer that a cell phone is not like a normal phone. People don't even realize that cordless phones, your home cordless phone, emits RF. I believe that people have the right to be informed of what they are exposed to, regardless of whether or not it's at a level that can cause them something like a thermal heating effect. I'd like to use the analogy of salt. We all know that salt is in our diet. Some people choose to pursue low sodium options for a number of reasons. We make those labels very clear to people. I don't see, from a communication perspective, this being much different. So I know that we don't have a lot of time. There were more findings from the public input that the Royal Society collected. I commend the Royal Society for including a space for a public voice on this issue because I believe it is important. And I also will stop here and anticipate any questions you may have.
Okay. Thank you very much. Our final presentation for this panel, Ms. Crowe and Ms. Harrington. And I understand, Ms. Crowe, you'll be doing the presentation. And you have it on slides, so we'll see how our technology is performing. 10 out of 10.
So far.
So far, so good.
Great. Okay, Beth Harrington is my colleague, and we thank you for this opportunity. We've been working on wind turbine health risks and for about 7 years together. So some of you may ask, whoops.
there you go.
Which did you do? You pushed that one?
I did. This one.
Okay,
there you go.
Sorry about it. Okay, you may ask yourselves, why should wind turbines be considered under Safety Code 6? Well, we are finding people exposed to wind turbines are also complaining of the many symptoms and the issues that have been described by the previous speakers. And wind turbine facilities do emit electromagnetic energy and radio frequency because of its infrastructure and its operations. So, for example, under the infrastructure and operational mandate, they use remote monitoring Wi-Fi technologies for communications. They have databases and interfaces, transformer stations, and so forth. So from a community exposure point of view, they are exposed to these energies. The scale and the scope is a surprise because they monitor and use communication network 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And back in 2010, one of the wind turbine manufacturer companies indicated that there were about 6,000 globally remote operational centers established. And since that time, 5 years have gone past, and more approvals are occurring in Canada, in Ontario, and we're expecting more to come up. So the exposure is going to be higher. This is the reference there for that particular slide. We provided in a submission a number of references and links. And if you go on this particular link, you will see a large number of infrastructure modules and methods for how wind turbines are using the infrastructure and the communications network. We don't do solar ourselves. However, one of the methods, there's a solar panel up on the right-hand side that they are also monitoring through the infrastructure. We have competing claims about whether there's a risk or not, and this is of concern. It's very difficult to get the message out, but one study that was conducted in Ontario supported the official position of Health Canada that it didn't consider any precautionary measures because the levels of exposure were at home and at school. And incidentally, turbines are going around schools. is low and probably no conclusive evidence of an issue. We also have other competing claims where, while it's acknowledged by the National Collaborative Center for Environmental Health that the emissions do occur at these facilities, but the emissions for EMF are not a significant amount. Of interest, I think we're seeing a lot of interest generally of these types of emissions that we're talking about. And of interest is that we know that insurance companies are risk adverse, and this is a very interesting insurance process for engineers and architects where it appears liability that this electromagnetic fields for these two groups are not being underwritten. So we can see there's some interest there. One of the consultants for that does quite a lot of work for wind energy development notes that these fields can damage human health, so that's an industry acknowledgement. And also researchers here in Ontario have indicated that we can get electromagnetic waves exposure for some of the people through poor power quality, and that these people are adversely affected, the ones that are electrically hypersensitive or at risk. I'd like to talk a bit about the general population exposure, and this has already been very well done by Dr. Bray, where the Women's College Hospital is looking at this, and her very elegant presentation spoke to this. So we have general population exposure, and we haven't even considered the wind energy facilities yet. I'd like to move a little bit to show the potential risk factors through excerpts from the Bioinitiative Working Group, because they talk about risk factors and susceptibility for exposures for children, especially if they have had maternal exposure. And as well, they have a very strong statement that there's little doubt that the exposure to electromagnetic low frequencies can causes childhood leukemia. Another excerpt has been addressed by Dr. Bray that when we have children exposed, we don't know if that carries over into adult life. And that I think needs to have vigilance and long-term surveillance as well, because the impacts are significant, could be significant, affects cognitive, and behavioral control. As well, there's potential risk factors of women in the workplace where extremely low frequencies can be a risk factor for breast cancer over a prolonged period of time. And I think we would all be concerned about that type of exposure. Another exposure risk factor is the damage, potential damage to the DNA. So these are pretty serious and significant things. Now, the Bioinitiative Working Group did not speak about wind turbines per se, nor does Safety Code 6. However, the working group did identify another concept of labeling and informed choice, which has already been raised, but they speak about the smart grid and those technology tools that I've just talked about. And they note there's little labeling, little or no informed choice, and that people cannot get away from the source easily because it's quite pervasive in our society now. And we agree, my colleague and I, that there's been failed government partnership, like a failed government process here to help people. Of interest is in California, they have started to look at disclosure of risk, and one of the utilities there, the Con Ed, has distributed a brochure that addresses the scientific uncertainty and the opportunity for people to reduce EMF exposure if they can. So I think we're starting to see disclosure of risk. With respect to industrial wind turbine facilities, there's a lack of disclosure, no warning labels at all. And in fact, any risks to health are frequently dismissed. Those that step forward and talk about this when they've been exposed to wind energy sources are really dismissed and have a hard time to carry their message forward. And one other point is that non-participants, that would be people that have not signed agreements to host turbine facilities on their land, are exposed to these energy sources without consent. So we have that issue to face as well. I think the prevention model has been overlooked in this case. World Health does speak and advocate that if we have a reasonable possibility that public health is at risk or would be damaged, we don't need full scientific proof before taking some type of action. And I think that's required now. Whoops, excuse me. I had one more slide back there. You have yours up?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. No. It jumped.
Okay.
Okay, there
it is.
The advocate for children is quoted in the Policy Interpretation Network of Children's Health and Environment, and they also support that we don't need full scientific proof that before taking action. So we have not only from the children's perspective, but the general population. And there's something wrong with my keyboard. So we would like to recommend that industrial wind energy facilities and possibly solar facilities should be included under Safety Code 6. And this is based on the discussion around the operation and infrastructure. As I've briefly described, we have a 10-page briefing note with references available to the committee. I think you have to back up. And we also have an expected increase of facilities with more exposure going to happen. Risk factors are being explored and discussed, so we're on our way to looking at that. And there's an opportunity for the committee to capture the aggregate of all possible exposures. And I'm going to try this key again. It did it. Our recommendations are that investigation of Safety Code 6 be broadened to include industrial wind energy and solar facilities. And we would like to see, while we have to be concerned at the general population at large, that priorities be given to the fetus and neonate exposure, babies, children, youth, the elderly, and those with pre-existing medical conditions or disease and special needs. I think we all are concerned as a society that our youth are at risk and possibly at risk and vulnerable to long-term effects. And we also would recommend that requirements for public disclosure about risk factors be established I think this will go a long ways. My final wrap-up is that we have to understand that these facilities are not installed in urban communities. They are being installed in rural communities, and there, no attention to these emissions is being done right now. Alors, merci beaucoup pour votre...
Thank you very much for your attention.
Okay, thank you very much. That concludes our presentations, and now we'll have some questions. And again, we're going to trim it from 7 minutes to 5 minutes just to make sure we have a full round. So first up, I'll make sure we'll do our translation test here. So if you don't have an earpiece or if you need translation, put your earpiece in. And Ms. Moore will run a test before we start her time just to make sure everybody understands. Okay?
Okay.
Go ahead, Ms. Moore.
Est-ce que tout le monde?
Does everybody who needs interpretation, has everybody installed their earpieces, and do you hear me clearly?
Neither do I. I have to have questions. Yeah. I'll need questions in English if possible.
Pour les gens qui sont,
for the people who are outside of this room on a video conference, normally you receive the interpretation in the language of your choice. Are you hearing me in English right now?
Toronto says yes.
Parfait. Donc,
I would like to ask questions of Ms. Bray and the two researchers who are with us here in Ottawa. When last week we had witnesses before us, there were 140 studies that had been, we were told, given to Health Canada, and only 36 of these 140 were not included in the Health Canada study because there was a difficulty with the scientific standards in them. This is what I want to know. Perhaps with some caveats, should those studies not have been seen as early warning signs? Because there were so many of these studies. In your opinion, are we at a stage where scientific information indicates that there is concern, enough concern on a matter on the table that should lead to possible protection of a vulnerable group, women, children, for example? In your opinion, is there enough scientific data that would allow for the application of the principle of prudence?
Absolutely. We have enough information to put that on board. There needs to be studies in other areas related to this field, but in terms of the precautionary principle and putting that into place right now, it is imperative that we do that, absolutely imperative, that we don't wait.
The first thought is that we listen to the people that are telling us that they're having some problems. And that is, unless we start to acknowledge that there's risk factors and issues here, we can never move forward to solve it. And it is related to proximity and the full-scale emissions that are there 724, 365 days a year. So I'm in agreement that we have enough warning signs to move forward. And it may take a while to build what we call the scientific certainty. Sometimes you can't have scientific certainty for a long time. Many conditions in medicine are known that we don't have scientific certainty about a causality, but we know we treat and we look after that and we remove the source as much as possible. So.
With respect to patients now, what are the recommendations that are often made to reduce exposure. What type of recommendation do you regularly make, Ms. Bray, to patients?
Avoidance of the exposure, and then we try to talk about distancing. We try to make sure that at home there is as little EMF exposure as possible, especially during sleep, that they turn off everything that might be emitting, their routers, etc., that they get corded phones as opposed to cordless phones in their home, that they basically clean up their home in that regard. At work, it's not so easy because accommodations can cause job loss, conflicts, and a lot of friction between bosses and workers. And so these folks need to be educated about shielding and protecting themselves so that they can actually navigate through the day and be able to do their jobs. And it basically requires a unified approach, but unfortunately there isn't enough in our society that helps these folks, protects them, or even looks at the possibility of there being a problem. So we have a very big uphill battle that we need to deal with every patient. And we also have to address their other physical and, you know, problems that they need to be helped upon so that they can tolerate the exposures better on a daily basis. And so that takes a bit of time as well. And we spend many hours with patients at a time to try to get to the bottom of their exposure histories.
Thank you very much. Ms. McLeod?
Chair, and I'm going to, if you could let me know when I'm at 3 minutes, my colleague, Ms. Gallant, would like 2 minutes, so I guess I better move fairly quickly. I'll start with Dr. Nicol. I spent this weekend not only going through the briefs, but trying to do my own literature review on this issue, and I can tell you as I think I became more confused in terms of some very, very people with some very strong credentials and some very different viewpoints on you know, what the harms potentially are. So I think I'm not sure that my weekend was spent all that well in terms of getting a clearer picture. So to go back to the Royal Society, I have to go back to the process that we set in place was to have people that are more expert than myself take on that task. So could you please, I know that there's been some concerns about the process, but if you could maybe walk us through as someone that participated in that process, you know, how you sort of went through and analyzed the different science that was out there, the different reports that were out there.
I can speak to that, although only in part, recognizing that my role was not to discuss the health impacts per se. I was brought on more as a person to understand public perception and risk perception, but the process was we were given a question to answer. It was a very specific question to evaluate the scientific rigor. And why I say that, I frame that, is that there's actually, I believe, a bigger question that could have been asked or could be asked again. And it also addresses what we're hearing a lot from is concerns around the health impacts and risks of this technology. But this was not a risk or risk-benefit analysis. So what we didn't hear from were people who are happy about RF, to say the people who find RF important for their work. So the question was bounded very much by what is the scientific evidence for harm. And it wasn't a bigger question of how do we manage this risk or how do we deal with competing risk-benefit interests. So that very narrow question, what we did is there were scientists, experts from all over the world. I can tell you there was lively debate amongst them about how we were going to collate all the evidence, the discussions of lower dose exposures, what the health impacts were, and the frustration of not being able to say with any sort of certainty what's going on in low dose levels. And I believe that one of our major recommendations, which I'm hearing echoed around, is that we need better, more robust research on this area. It looks like there's signals in that body of literature, which is a large body of literature, but it's very scattered. So the information on thermal heating, which is what Safety Code 6 is all about, is quite clear. The rest of it is quite scattered, and we need better informed research to bring that together so that we have clearer answers so we can take precautionary steps and try and find a level that might actually be more acceptable to everybody. But when you start to talk about questions of acceptance and risk management, that's a bigger question than just a scientific question. It's what is our society, and as Canada, what do we want to do as a country around regulating this exposure? And that doesn't just have to do with science. It has to do with the benefits of the technology, the impacts of on a larger scale. We're a big country. We need technologies that move information across the country, but we also need to do it in a way that's safe. And I think that that's a much bigger question than what we got asked to do in the Royal Society panel. And I believe those questions are valid and need to be addressed. Okay. And I think I just got lost on the screen. But.
Ms. Gallant, you've got about a minute. I apologize.
Thank you very much. I have two questions. One, I heard childhood leukemia, and I'd like to know what the epidemiology between that and RFs, EMFs are. And I also understand and would like Ms. Crow to answer my question with respect to comparing and contrast how the initial cases of thalidomide compared to the anecdotal type of evidence that we're seeing through with the EMFs.
Someone want to do the first question first? Is that Dr.
You, you better do that first,
okay,
because we might not have time.
Well, there's analogies with that where you have to listen to the people first. They're the start. And we have, for example, some situations, the thalidomide is one example that was ignored for some years, the history of it. And we also have things like fibromyalgia. We don't know exactly what caused it, yet we treat and we do whatever we can to avoid what we suspect are exposures. Chronic fatigue syndrome, another example. So there's a lot of conditions where there's analogies that we could follow, and we're seeing risk. People are telling us. I'm not a physician, but I'm used to vigilance monitoring and surveillance. And as pointed out, we don't have those kinds of mechanisms in place right now. And we need go-to places, as described by Dr. Bray. And so there's a lot that we could do, but you've got to start and work with the people first and listen to them.
We are quite a bit over time, so we'll have to catch that next question on another round. Ms. Fry, go ahead, please.
Thank you very much. I want to thank everybody for the presentations, and I want to apologize for being late. There's some stuff going on, and I'm being called to the telephone on emergency calls during this time, so I was late for listening to what you have to say. But I was reading the presentation from Ms. Crow and Beth Harrison, so Beth Harrington, and I heard some of what you had to say, Ms. Nicol. The bottom line really is we know that there is not conclusive evidence linking cause and effect. We know, however, there is an upgrading to a possible carcinogen by the World Health Organization. We have had people telling us about linkages that may not have the causality piece in it, but make us want to stop and think. And I think that, for me, the question is simply this. We should have learned lessons from cigarettes. We should have learned lessons from acid rain. We should have learned lessons from thalidomide. I mean, the question about thalidomide is a good one. In every case, as far as I'm concerned, this is a health committee. The ability to look at risk management, i.e. weigh up the benefit versus the risk, is always at the foremost of whatever you do. And you mentioned that, and you mentioned that as well. But I think, for me, when we're talking about human health, and we have historic experiences of how, you know, we went ahead and we allowed things to happen, and we are now trying to deal with the fallout on it in terms of cigarettes. How many people have died from cardiovascular disease? It's not just lung cancer, but from COPD, emphysema. How many people have been severely maimed through thalidomide when at that time it was just one person's gut feeling in the United States that said, let's not do this, that eventually we saw that that was right. The bottom line for me is simply this. The precautionary principle is extremely important. My mother, who is neither a scientist nor a researcher nor anything like that, used to always say, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. A pound of prevention is worth an ounce of cure. Whatever. In other words, if you prevent things, then you will actually prevent the fallout. And when we talk about human health, especially in this particular instance, I just think we need to err on the side of precaution. And you have suggested, Ms. Crow, that we look at some things that are happening in California here, which is brochures that help people to know, to be warned, some kind of warning, you know, caveat emptor kind of thing. And then what can you do to minimize your use? And I think if that is all, as you say, the thermal, we had lots of people tell us that you know, looking at just the thermal effects was kind of only looking at a certain sector of the community who use electromagnetic radiation. We're not talking about thermal effects. We're talking about, you know, other kinds of effects. So my question is simply this. Would you recommend, all of you, that we work with industry to develop some sort of brochure or whatever to tell people, look, there may be linkage? Because you do that on labeling, you know, this may cause a problem. Please be careful when you're using it. People do it to protect themselves. Companies do it all the time. And then talk to people about how you unplug the monitors, you don't put your baby. Just simple little precautionary measures that we could do. I think that, for me, is something I would like to see happen. And I would also like to hear what you think about that and what you think about Health Canada working with groups like you who are not part of this panel, that are people that are researchers, that are people that are actually out there in the field, that might be able to help to look at a reasonable way of telling people this could cause problems, and here's how you might use it more carefully down the road, and dealing with industry to look at how they can minimize the amount of radiation, the amount of how you use their products and whether they can do things with their products. We see that Europe does it. Europe have, we saw some actual examples here from what was happening in Europe with regard to cordless phones and what's happening with regard to child monitors. So I just wondered if any of you had any comment on how we could do that without causing a panic and going, oh, my God, this is going to harm you, but do that sort of precautionary kind of use.
If I may address that,
sorry,
Hedy, I actually,
sorry, up for a quick. We're right at 5 minutes, so okay. If you could provide some very brief comments, that'd be great.
Okay, I think the answer is yes. I think it's necessary. I think that we need labeling, we need awareness, we need government leadership. People aren't necessarily going to believe what a manufacturer says by themselves because they're trying to sell you something. So some form of labeling and better awareness about what's in products, particularly products in the home and ones that you keep close to your body where we know exposure is higher, is merited and should be considered.
Okay. Well said. Ms. Bray, did you want to comment briefly?
Yes, I think there should be some legislation in schools to have hard wiring throughout and not expose our children to this unnecessary radiation. As we've talked about the precautionary principle, I think it's very important that there be some legislation saying that everything needs to be hardwired and Wi-Fi be used only if necessary, and that hubs should be turned off if they're not in use, and so therefore you decrease exposure of a vast number of children to unnecessary radiation. And we don't know where we're going with that, just like the tobacco industry and everything else that's come before that. In my speech, I was saying that. So,
to be fair with time, we should go to Mr. Lizon because he has the last question for this panel. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, witnesses, for coming today. First question I have to Dr. Bray. Electromagnetic radiation has been around for, I don't know, over 100 years probably, ever since the electricity was invented. And people have been exposed to it in different settings for many, many years. Is there a case of negligence, that there is no studies, no conclusive studies done on the impact of electromagnetic radiation on human body, because it's workers or workplaces working around electric motors? You can name many, many professions where people are impacted, and there must be some kind of impact on their health. Therefore, how come we neglected it for so many years?
Okay, there are a lot of questions there, but long and short is that the occupational medicine side of this has a lot of studies showing how workers are affected by microwaves and radio waves. And as you know, this all started way back about 100 years ago, but now it's throughout our whole society. Adults are not the only ones being exposed. So we don't have anything on children. Are we going to wait until the children start developing cancers, et cetera, to act? We don't have any studies like that. We don't want to do longitudinal studies on a vulnerable population. So, yes, indeed, studies are missing, but they're missing because we've never had this amount of microwave and radio wave radiation in our society, in everyday lives, in people's homes, in their bedrooms, at their schools, at their work, at such high volumes. And we're looking at all different types of frequencies and power outputs, and we're looking at clusters of technology that has never occurred before. It's unprecedented in society, and our ancestors, my grandparents or my great-grandparents, had not a single ounce of this when they were, you know, in existence. It's 10 million times greater on us than it ever has been, and it's a huge amount, and that cannot be studied easily and has not been studied. And so basing our actions today on studies done 30 or 50 years ago or what have you, or even occupational studies, does not help us at all. It's not practical, and it's not what reality is about.
You know what? You used in your remarks an expression, the canary in the mine. You know, I'm a mining engineer by profession, and I can assure you the canaries have not been used in mine for many, many years. There are devices. The science have made a great progress. And I truly feel like in this case, on this topic, we are at that time where the mining was using those little birds to check the quality of air in the mines. Do I have a little bit of time?
2 minutes.
To Madame Nicole, you mentioned that when you were working on the Royal Society reviewing the science, what did you mean by you were reviewing the science, that something, if there is not much that exists, what can be reviewed to come to any conclusive results?
So as an epidemiologist, we have what are called hierarchies of evidence, in which we evaluate studies based on how well they're done. There's specific ingredients that are necessary in order to consider a body of literature valid. It is the basis of my field, and it is what we use. And the evidence fits into that structure best around thermal effects. The challenge is that the bioinitiative results and all of the other science that's coming along does not fit into the parameters of prudent epidemiology. And what we need in order to make a scientific-based ruling, which uses that type of evidence, is we need to find lower level exposures and do the kinds of quality studies that would allow us to use that rubric on that body of evidence. Health Canada could commission research. Industry Canada could do research. We could actually try to address this problem in a way that makes sense and allows us to rigorously evaluate it with the same degree that we evaluate thermal heating.
That's about it.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. We're right on time. We're going to suspend for a couple minutes. We'll excuse our panelists here, our guests, and then we'll bring on our new set, and we'll be starting right up and carrying on. So we'll suspend for a couple minutes.
Thank you, ladies. Have a nice day.
Thank you.
using the technology, and you can just start when you're ready.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah.
Good. So I'll just start then.
Yes, please.
Yes. So my presentation is called Evidence Indicates a Plausible Link Between Autism and Radiofrequency Radiation Exposure. And my name is Martha Herbert. I'm a board-certified neurologist with special competency in child neurology and specialization in neurodevelopmental disorders, and I am a research neuroscientist. I'm on the faculty of Harvard Medical School, on staff at the Massachusetts General Hospital, and an affiliate of the Harvard MGH MIT Martinos Center for Biomedical Imaging. I have an extensive history of research and clinical practice in neurodevelopmental disorders, particularly autism spectrum disorders, and I've published research papers in brain imaging, physiological abnormalities in autism spectrum disorders, and environmental influences on neurodevelopmental disorders such as autism, as well as on brain development and function. Increasing prevalence of autism and the numbers from the USA and its high costs. Autism spectrum disorder diagnoses are increasing rapidly in North America as well as elsewhere, with profound effects on those affected, including parents, as well as parents, families, caregivers, communities, and societies at large. In the U.S., the rates have gone from 3 to 4 in 10,000 20 years ago to over 1 in 68 today. Annual costs for treatment of an affected child can reach between $40,000 and $60,000, with lifetime support for an individual costs topping $1.2 to $3.2 per affected individual. This translates now into approximately $240 billion a year annually in the U.S. The prevalence in the graph shows a striking prevalence over the last 10 or 15 years. Those are CDC figures. And in the next slide, you see that there are many factors associated with autism spectrum disorder numbers, including parental age, greater awareness, increased diagnosis, spatial clustering. But there's a large proportion in this graph, 46%. In another paper from the University of California, Davis, there was 65% unaccounted for by these other factors. And potentially, at least some of that may be associated with environmental influences. So what is autism? It is difficult for many to imagine how autism could be influenced by environmental factors, but this difficulty comes from holding assumptions, particularly that autism is genetically hardwired into the brain from birth or conception. While this assumption is referred to and utilized by many scientists in interpreting their data, the actual assumption is not proven scientifically and probably cannot be. More and more scientific and clinical observations suggest that we need to think about autism differently than that. Autism is not a broken brain. Many with autism are highly gifted, albeit with issues that are often dyspraxic. That is to say, problems with expression and coordination, not lack of capability, not purely genetic. Hundreds of genes by now are associated with autism. They're also common in healthy people. The environment plays a big role. Autism is not a life sentence. It's variable, changeable. It can get worse and better in a day or even in moments. It's treatable, and some people lose their diagnosis, and high intelligence is common. And the assumption now out of date that low intelligence was by far predominant was never proven and is now not consistent with the facts. Autism may be centrally about brain function, which is pertinent to the comments about electromagnetic fields and RFR, and it may turn out to be more about impaired or altered function than about altered brain anatomy, since the anatomical differences are subtle, while the functional differences are more striking. And autism involves not just the brain, multiple systems are involved. While it's defined psychologically by a set of neurocognitive symptoms, much research has identified many underlying systemic physiological disturbances at the molecular, cellular, organ system, and brain nervous system levels. And researchers are starting to study the way these physiological functional disturbances alter brain function. Particularly important is the electrophysiology, the brain waves and other electrical properties of the central and autonomic nervous system. The underlying chemistry and health of the cells in the brain and nervous system set the terms within which the brain can function. As it turns out, the alterations in cell chemistry and physiology that have been identified in autism have virtually all been documented as effects of electromagnetic frequencies, including radio frequency radiation. Other environmental exposures and genetic vulnerabilities may also contribute to this impairment of cell function. But the cumulative effect, the total load of these environmental stressors, is likely to be what causes autism and triggers or exacerbates its challenging behaviors. And we can do something about the contribution of electromagnetic fields. So might autism contribute to the development or worsening of autism spectrum disorders or conditions? My co-author Cindy Sage and I wrote a paper called Autism and EMF? Plausibility of a Pathophysiological Link, which is published in the peer-reviewed journal Pathophysiology in Parts 1 and 2 in June of 2013. And I posted it on my personal website, marthaherbert.org. And a short summary for a lay audience was recently published online in Autism Notebook. In this longer paper and in the shorter one, we delineate parallels between observed dysfunctions in autism and biological effects of electromagnetic radiation. The damage induced and seen in autism spectrum disorders includes oxidative and cellular stress, lipid peroxidation in membranes and other lipid substances, stress protein responses, genetic alterations and de novo mutations, altered membrane and barrier structure and function, calcium channel disturbances, and altered function at cell junctions. And there's a slide schematically illustrating the different types of damage at the cellular level that are found in autism spectrum disorders and that overlap just about entirely with cellular functional problems that are inducible by EMF-RFR. At a higher level of organization, there's a degradation of functional systems, both caused by EMF-RFR and present in autism spectrum disorders or conditions, which include dysfunction in energy and metabolism seen in the mitochondria and in altered brain glucose metabolism. Alteration of important functions in the perinatal infancy period. Brain cell structure alteration and damage. Melatonin dysregulation. And conversely, melatonin can attenuate the impacts of EMF-RFR. Immune dysfunction. Electrophysiological alterations. It is very notable that these physiological disturbances are mirrored in many other common and costly chronic diseases. These include diabetes, cancer, obesity, hypertension, neurodegenerative disorders, and more. The cumulative cost of these conditions is enormous to the point of straining our healthcare systems and economics beyond tolerance. Now, electrophysiological perturbations are central to autism spectrum disorders and also are a significant in overall effects of EMF and RFR. Altered molecular, cellular, and physiological function in the brain and body, along with altered immunity, in turn impact the electrical signaling activities of the brain and nervous system. Electrophysiological perturbations are seen in many conditions, including seizures and epilepsy, sleep disturbances, sensory processing, diminutions of cognitive efficiency, and autonomic dysregulation such as elevated heart rate and stress reactivity. And these features are all present in many or even most people with autism spectrum disorders. Moreover, these effects, when induced by EMF-RFR, occur at exposure levels substantially below safety code 6. Now let's talk about children's vulnerabilities. Children are not little adults. They are developing, and perturbations during windows of development may have lifelong repercussions. In August of 2013, the American Academy of Pediatrics addressed in writing, in a letter to the U.S. FCC, their concerns about the needs for reevaluating EMF-RFR, given that exposure has skyrocketed while regulations in place in the U.S. date back to 1996, way before this exposure acceleration occurred. The AAP expressed particular concern about the use of devices like cell phones and laptops in pregnant and nursing mothers and children. Safety Code 6, it should be noted, has seen only minor modifications since being introduced in 1979. Radiation from cell phones and other sources penetrates deeper into the heads of children, which leads to persistent stress on the cells in the brain, and over time, more and more serious problems can develop. Certain tissues, and there's the slide showing from left to right, greater penetration in the brain of cell phone exposure in a child, less in an older child and still less in an adult.
Excuse me, Ms. Herbert.
Of a child's...
Excuse me. We're at 11 minutes here, and we're a little over time. I was just wondering if you be able to conclude in the next maybe...
Wrap up?
Yeah, and then we'll flesh it out more with questions.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. The tissue, just to say that there are differences in tissue and geometry in children's heads, that use of cell phones in children below 20 can result in a fivefold increase in glioma and acoustic neuroma, and exposure in utero and from birth is huge. And exposure, concomitant body burden of other substances like lead can make the consequences worse. So the conclusion is the vulnerability of children and individuals with highly prevalent and costly illnesses should be a major consideration in discussion of risks. And we need new public standards to go as low as reasonably achievable. And there are many precautionary and also simple practical everyday methods to minimize exposure to radiation that should be aggressively presented to the public in an educational way, with particular attention to reducing children's exposure, banning Wi-Fi in daycare, preschools, and up to grade 3, and turning off Wi-Fi when not being used, and banning marketed of wireless to children. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay. Next up from the Environmental Health Trust, Ms. Davis, go ahead.
Good afternoon. It's an honor to be here, and I want to thank the committee for inviting me to talk with you today. I'm going to talk with you about the impact of electromagnetic field on male and female reproduction from current devices. I want to stress that in Safety Code 6, they said they did not include some of the 140 studies because the exposure used was not adequate. I'm going to skip with talking to you a great deal about my credentials. They are in the next slide. You have an opportunity to look at them later. Just to say that I did my doctorate at the University of Chicago. I did 3 postdocs, the last one of which was a postdoctoral master's in public health at Johns Hopkins University. And for 10 years, I was the founding director of the Board on Environmental Studies and Toxicology at the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. I also was a member of the group awarded the Nobel Peace Prize with Al Gore in 2007 for serving as a lead author on several chapters of the report for the United Nations on climate change. I was the founding director of the Center for Environmental Oncology at the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute, and I've received various awards, including a Lifetime Achievement Award from Green America, as well as a National Book Award for my first book, When Smoke Ran Like Water. I've worked with officials in the United Nations and governments in India, Japan, and Canada, and I'm pleased to be here today to try to work with the committee as it looks for advice on a very important and troubling issue. I want to stress that in my remarks today, I'm going to talk to you about experiments that have been done on male and female animals, but one of those animals happens to be human, and I'll get to that in a moment, with currently used cell phones at current exposures. I want to stress that. So what we see is that if you look at the studies that have been done at the Cleveland Clinic, which I think is well known as an outstanding research center, at the Australia National Center for Research on Male Health, and at other institutions around the world, They have all reported similar results to what I'm going to show you here today. They've taken sperm from men, and they have put them into two test tubes. One test tube gets exposed to cell phone radiation for 2 hours. The other test tube does not. Now, sperm will die because they're not supposed to live in a test tube. But the rate that they die and what happens to them in that 2 hours tells you a lot biologically. Let's look here at the results from Professor John Aitken, Cambridge University trained, and he is, in fact, a knight, so it's Sir John Aitken. He showed, if you look on the top left, the control, the white box, those are the sperm that lived after 2 hours with nothing being done to them. On the right, the lower black box, those are the number of sperm that lived after 2 hours of being exposed to a normal operating cell phone. On the other right, you see what we call a measure of motility, which is how well the sperm swim. And sperm, we need millions of sperm to make one healthy baby, so they have to be good swimmers. And then bottom, on your bottom left, you see an indication of damage to DNA. And specifically, the DNA on the mitochondria of the sperm, which is the mitochondria are the engines of the sperm. And you see that the control sperm on the bottom left has very little damage after 2 hours. The exposed sperm have almost four times more damage as measured by standard laboratory tests conducted, again, by the equivalent of the National Institutes of Health of Australia. Now, my colleague, Stan Glantz, who's a professor of biostatistics at the University of California, San Francisco, has concluded, based on all of the evidence, and I'm just showing you here one study, that cell phones do, in fact, damage sperm. This is, and it does it at a level that does not produce heat. So the fact that Safety Code 6 repeatedly said there were no proven effects without heat, they did not include these studies. And this is, I think, a very big omission, and I would think all of you here would understand that we have to protect sperm if we want to protect the continuation and the health of the species. The next slide shows you a very interesting study that was done with a laptop directly over the petri dishes of the sperm, and it was insulated so there was no heat, because we know that heat will kill sperm. And this study again shows a significant increase in damage to the sperm that had been exposed to the laptop, as opposed to the control sperm. Now, I think this is very, very important results. Now, you know, nowadays they call them tablets because they belong on tables. They're tested 20 centimeters away from a body. Industry has advice about how to use these things, and I applaud them because recently they've become more forthright with advice that I'm going to show you at the end about how to use these things safely. I think the government's job is to make sure people know what advice is buried now, including that a laptop is supposed to be kept 20 centimeters away from the body. And all of these little children with their iPads right next to their bodies, their arms aren't even 20 centimeters long. Now, the next slide is I recently came from India, where I was working with the government that is, in fact, conducting major research that is quite outstanding and I think would offer some examples to what could be done easily here in Canada. And the Indian government sponsored research on, again, mobile phone radiation using a computer to generate the mobile phone signal. So it was a standard generated signal. And they exposed middle-aged male rats, maybe an age group of interest to this group, for cell phone radiation for 2 hours a day. Well, you'd rather have, all right, for 2 hours a day for just 45 days. And at the end of that, they did sophisticated biochemistry and found increased DNA, lower testosterone, and lower fertility in when the animals were allowed to breed. And if you looked at the testis, which they did here, you see that the normal testis, you see that nice, round, regular barrier, that's what we need, cells to be intact, to have a nice membrane around them. Cell phone radiation, as Dr. Herbert just said very eloquently, can damage membranes. It can disrupt the integrity of the cell. And the damaged testis you see on the right comes from the animals that were exposed. The ones on the left were not. Now I want to show you a study that I think it may explain some of what Dr. Herbert's results suggest. And I want to stress, what I'm showing you here is one study. There are many of this type, and they're done by, in this case, a laboratory in Turkey, sponsored by NATO. NATO sponsored this research for years because the research is on radar. Radar, of course, is a form of microwaves. Cell phones emit microwave radiation as a two-way radio. The term used to describe that radiation is radio frequency energy. It is not a precise term. It is, in fact, a small form of radar. It is a form of microwave radiation. And none of these terms, microwave or radio frequency radiation, is a precise term. This study done by Turkey, and I say it's exemplary of others, took two groups of animals and exposed one group prenatally to a computer-generated signal to mimic a current cell phone. And the results, I think, are quite stunning. If you look on the left, you will see what are healthy cells. You see all those nice round little circles. Those membranes are intact on the left. And you see them magnified in the control. If you look on the right and look at the top, you see fewer cells and more damage. Now, I want to stress, this could explain part of what Dr. Herbert's talking about, because what we're seeing here is alterations in DNA and membrane damage caused by prenatal exposure to cell phones. We don't know what's behind this epidemic of autism. We don't. But certainly this is an important hypothesis that needs to be fully explored and can be done so. Now, the next slide shows you the results of Dr. Hugh Taylor's work at Yale, which I know Dr. Herbert is quite aware of. And that study found prenatally exposed animals produced offspring with significant behavioral problems, as measured by standard assays that had been replicated in animal studies. Essentially a form of hyperactivity in the animals. Dr. Taylor says the animals were literally bouncing off the walls. And this could be an example. What we've talked about with Dr. Suleiman Kaplan's work on the brain, this is maybe showing you the consequences of that. Finally, new data that I'm sharing here with the committee for the first time comes from the Korean government. Their Ministry of Science has released these numbers, showing a rapid growth in smartphone addiction rate, and I need not tell you that there is an addiction going on, and an addiction classified by physicians and others as needing treatment, by the way, and a change in the number of dementia patients under age 65, when dementia is really only thought to occur in inherited cases of risk. So where are we now? We, as the opening comments made, several other speakers have indicated, we must act on facts and we must take precaution. Now let's talk about certainty. We asked about how certain we were about health effects. We can't be certain because epidemiology, which I do, predicts nothing. It only proves the past. Epidemiology can tell you about the past. It cannot and should not be used to try to set public policy. We can't wait for proof of dead bodies or sick people at this point. We've got to act on what we know to prevent harm. Now, several different governments have taken steps, and I will just mention a few of them to you. In Belgium, France, and Taiwan, it is against the law, literally, to give a phone to a child age 2, and in Belgium and France, it's age 7. They're not allowed. There's actually a law was passed, a national law. Information on this can be found on our website. India has informally advised nobody to use a phone more than an hour a day in government policy. So Health Canada's document actually supports this statement, and I commend Health Canada, and I commend Safety Code 6, because it did announce that we should take special steps for children. And that is, in fact, a policy decision, because we don't want to treat our children or the rest of us like lab rats in an experiment with no controls. And just to give you what the industry has done, Lloyd's of London and Swiss Re will not cover health damages from cell phones. Will not. And all the warnings appear now inside these devices. The bill that is proposed here would give those warnings and make them available publicly. We have done that on a website called showthefineprint.org. And you can find that and more information on our website and that of C4ST. In short, it's better to be safe than sorry. I'd be glad to take your questions.
Thanks very much. Mr. Lord, welcome. And it's your turn to present. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My name is Bernard Lord. I am the President and the CEO of the Canadian Wireless Telecommunications Association. I'm here today with Kurt Eby. Kurt is the Director of Government Relations and Regulatory Affairs with the CWTA. As the voice of the wireless sector in Canada, the CWTA represents wireless service providers as well as companies that develop and produce products and services for the industry, including handsets, equipment manufacturers, content providers, and app makers. And I'm pleased to be here today to participate in the work of the Standing Committee's study on Safety Code 6. Let me state from the outset that the wireless sector in Canada does not set or impose standards or guidelines. Safety Code 6 is enforced by Industry Canada as the standard that is set in Canada, and that standard is set by Health Canada, and the wireless sector in Canada fully complies. The wireless sector will continue to be responsible in adhering to the science-based safety standards enforced by the Government of Canada and set by the Government of Canada. We commend the committee for its science-based review that you're conducting today. The wireless sector in Canada, as well as around the world, is committed to a completely open process in the study of health and safety issues related to wireless technologies. Studies of the health effects of EMFs have been ongoing for decades and will probably continue for a while to come. The overwhelming evidence of the credible scientific community has determined and published in studies worldwide continues to support the conclusion that there is no demonstrated public health risk associated with the use of wireless technology. In fact, when we look at the way the Canadians use wireless technology, we can safely state that wireless technology makes our communities safer. Canadians are among the heaviest users of wireless technology in the world. We enjoy some of the fastest, most robust networks anywhere you can find. It helps us stay connected with family and friends. It helps businesses be more productive. And we know that in times of emergency, wireless technology is extremely important. An overwhelming majority of 911 calls made in our communities come from wireless devices. We also know that some families, especially under 35, close to 75% of families, don't have a traditional landline, in fact, use wireless only. Government agencies responsible for establishing safe limits for signal levels of wireless devices also support that wireless technology are safe and are not a health risk. The signal levels from all wireless devices and networks are well below the safety limits established by Health Canada and other international governmental departments. Again, when exposures remain below the safety limits set by science-based EMF exposure standards, including Health Canada's Safety Code 6, no adverse effects have been proven through credible scientific evidence. The sector has always supported scientific research into this topic and fully supports any ongoing research that is deemed necessary by the respected scientific community. Just the same, the sector has always adhered to the science-based safety standards set by the Government of Canada and will continue to do so in the future. I really thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I thought I'd keep my remarks brief, and I'm very happy to answer any questions that you would have. Et ça me fera plaisir de les répondre en français aussi. I'd
be very happy to answer in French as well.
Mr. Adam and Aiko, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you very much, Chair, and thanks to everybody for being here. You made a statement, Mr. Lord, that wireless technology makes us safer. We've just listened to witnesses and the previous witnesses and Dr. Herbert and also Dr. Davis that may not agree with you. We've looked at, they've done studies on child vulnerability, the stress on the brain, autism. Our previous witnesses talked about the fact that there have been no studies on exposure level in schools, or the lack of accountability. We've been told that 3% of the population is affected severely by this technology. We've touched on childhood leukemia, potential DNA damage. I presented at a hearing in British Columbia sponsored by the Utilities Commission on smart meters, and I also found industry dismissive, and that was Fortis. When we presented cases of some of the things I just outlined, basically said, well, if you can't handle it, well, then don't, it's too bad. So I'm just wondering why industry has taken this approach, why there haven't been more detailed study on behalf of industry, and why you're not applying the precautionary principle to ensure that there's safety for Canadians. We've been, many studies have been done, and my colleague wanted to mention this, about the cumulative effects when we talk about smart meters and cell phones and wireless and routers. Have you been looking at any of these studies? And why are you not concerned of the potential and or the current impact to the health of Canadians? I'd like to have some answers from you.
I'm very happy to answer those questions, and thank you very much for the question. I will address two things that you say. First of all, we rely on the scientific evidence that is produced worldwide, and we rely on the standards that are set by agencies such as Health Canada, and we comply with those standards. We don't set the standards.
Look, I'm just going to interrupt you. Sorry, we don't have much time. We understand that, and that's why we're here, because we're trying to review Safety Code 6. There are other studies. We've just had Dr. Davis talk about studies. We've had other people that have appeared, research that I've been through over the past couple of years, and yet you're saying that the studies that have you are relying on and Safety Code 6, everything's fine. I don't quite understand that.
Well, you should. I'm not the one who produced those studies, so I will not defend the studies. I will defend the scientists. And those scientists are hired, and they conduct their studies independently. And it is their role to set the standards to ensure the safety of Canadians. And what I'm telling you today is the industry and the sector in Canada fully complies with those standards. I personally believe that those standards keep us safe. And that when you use the devices under the limits that are set, they are believed to be safe in Canada and around the world. And there's been numerous studies, and there's all sorts of studies that have been made. And the World Health Organization has concluded that if you use them according to the limits, it is safe. When I say that wireless devices keep us safer, I can tell you as a parent. I'm a parent. My daughter left today. She's in South America, and she can communicate with me because of her wireless device. I believe that that makes her safer, that she has that device with her. When you consider how many 911 calls that are made in Canada using wireless telecommunication, it does keep her community safer. When you talk about the precautionary principle, it is applied by the standards that are set by Safety Code 6 and Health Canada. And you should ask the scientists that have set that standard to explain to you how it is applied here in Canada.
In your opinion, the fact that Belgium, France, and Taiwan have regulated cell phones for children, is that not a red flag that maybe we should be doing that for your children and others here in Canada?
Well, my children are older than that now, obviously. That's something that legislators can consider. Legislators decide for all sorts of reasons to pass legislation. What I'm suggesting today and what I commend the committee for doing so far and what I commend the Government of Canada for doing is basing the regulation and their legislation based on science, not just innuendos or fear. Base it on science. And if the science demonstrate that the standards need to be changed, change the standards, keep the standards, but the industry and the sector in Canada will comply with the standards that are set by the Government of Canada.
Thank you very much.
Right on. Perfect. Right on 5 minutes. Okay. Mr. Young, you're up next, sir. Go ahead. 5 minutes.
Thank you, Chair. Dr. Davis, I read your book, Disconnect, and I found it to be very enlightening. In fact, I believe it's important. I have 5 minutes, so I'm going to ask you if I can ask you three questions during that time, and if you could provide around one-minute answers, we can get them all answered. If you'd help me with that, that would be... you're an expert on climate change, and most people believe that greenhouse gases play a causal role in global warming and in climate change. So this committee, we've heard from numerous independent scientists that cell phone radiation, including from Wi-Fi, baby monitors, portable phones, and tablets, plays a causal role in human health, including cancer and other diseases. Would you say that the level of evidence for radio frequency radiation causing adverse health effects is less or at the same level as the evidence for greenhouse gases causing global warming and climate change?
On the damaging effect of cell phone and other wireless radiation is as strong, if not stronger, than the evidence on climate change, which I reviewed as a member of the IPCC. I would also add that that's the reason why Lloyd's of London and Swiss Re in 1999 refused to cover health damages from cell phones. So there's obviously a concern there. And I would further point out that there is advice inside the phone that tells you this if you know how to find it. So I would say the evidence on the causal effect of mobile phone radiation on sperm, on pregnancy, on hearing, as well as cancer, including acoustic neuroma, which is a tumor of the hearing nerve, as well as leukemia, we have less firm evidence on. There's growing evidence showing a causal impact, yes.
Thank you. The American Association of Pediatrics recently held a conference where evidence was presented with regards to health effects of radiofrequency radiation on children. Could you please briefly tell us about this?
At the annual meeting of the American Academy of Pediatrics taking place in San Diego just a few days ago, they heard several studies reporting on the damaging effect of cell phone radiation on parent-child relationships, on the acquisition of language for children. Parents who are preoccupied with their cell phones, with their babies, with their infants, are not talking to those babies. And we know, those of us who've survived motherhood know, that talking to babies is how they learn to babble back at you. And you talk to your baby from the time you're pregnant, and when they're born, they know your voice. And you need to keep talking to them. I remember I was doing a postdoc reading to my child because I just wanted her to hear my voice. And if a parent is completely obsessed with these devices, their child's acquisition of language suffers.
Thank you. I would like to ask you a multiple question, the same question I asked the person at Health Canada who is ultimately responsible for Safety Code 6. Mm-hmm. And his reply sounded like the mayor in the movie Jaws saying the beaches are safe. Mm-hmm. So here's the question. Can you tell me, is it safe for my constituents to hold a cell phone to their heads? Is it safe for my 2.5-year-old granddaughter to have a baby monitor in her room all night? Is it safe for a woman to carry a cell phone in her bra? Is it safe for young men to carry cell phones in their front pants pockets? And is it safe for children to use cellular phones and tablets?
Well, you know, I guess it's easy to say no to all of those, except that if you have a sick child and you have a large house and you have a baby monitor that would be located far away and you were in Switzerland, you would get a baby monitor that only turned on when you needed it. Our baby monitors in the U.S. and Canada are programmed to be on 24/7. You could actually save greenhouse gases if the government right now mandated that all Wi-Fi devices could be automatically powered down when they weren't being used.
Chair, how many minutes for time?
It would actually not even be that difficult to imagine a way to save greenhouse gases. The Swiss phones, the Swiss so-called cordless phones, they don't broadcast 24/7. They're only used when the person needs it. And there's a way for software and hardware to be configured to make that happen. And no one has ever calculated the energy savings that would result from it. Okay. But it would be substantial.
Dr. Davis, we're hearing a lot of evidence of potential harm and evidence of harm. And the folks at Health Canada responsible for Safety Code 6 have taken this inflexible position. They seem like they have everything vested in saying it's safe. They don't even consider that they might not be right, and they're not offering any potential change. Why is it that we're hearing from you and others that there are real risks, and we're hearing from countries all over the world? Can you guess why Health Canada is taking this position?
Well, you know, of course you'll have to ask them, but I'd like to point out to you that among the countries that have recently established a National Institute for Research on Wireless Radiation Safety is Israel. Israel lives and dies by radar. They use it. They know what it is, and they know that they need to be smart in using it safely. Other countries are Taiwan and India. India is a high-tech country, has huge problems. The Indian Medical Research Council has a major study underway now of cell phone users and health because they think it's a serious public health issue in India. And that, again, it's a very high-tech country. So those countries have generally banned advertising with children and cell phones. That's an easy thing to do. Turkey did it. France has done it. It would be, I think, useful rather than to have the trash-talking babies with the cell phones, which look really cute, but it's a horrifying idea for many, many reasons, which the pediatricians and the developmental neuropsychiatrists talk about as well.
Okay,
an iPoddy, that is, a potty with a holder for an iPad, is a terrible idea, and yet it exists. And there are plastic baby teething rattle cases for iPhones, as well as iPads.
Okay.
And now, I do actually think
Davis,
that Safety Code 6 has done something good, and I want to commend them for that, because in the beginning, they acknowledge the need for more stringent standards for children. And Samsung, in its insert, it says a cell phone is not a toy. It would be good for that information to get more broadly distributed in getting the information out of the phones and onto them as labels.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Fry, go ahead.
Thank you very much. I want to thank again. Very interesting presentations today, Dr. Herbert and Dr. Davis. Very compelling evidence that you have, basically, with regard to autism and with regard to fertility. As a physician, I can tell you that it all makes a great deal of sense when you look at a mitochondrial breakdown of the cellular, of the walls and some of the slides that you showed us. My question, however, because I think your evidence is clear, compelling, very well done, your research is well done, I wanted to ask my question of Mr. Lord. Historically, it would seem to me that industry should be concerned. And we have listened now to 3 days or 3 sessions of presentations, the majority of which, and I say over 90% of which, has said to us that there is a clear causal evidence between not just autism, but brain tumors. There is clumping of red blood cells. There is fertility issues. There are many issues, and prenatal. We heard from the last group, prenatal problems with people who may or may not have worn, women who may have carried a laptop on their laps while they were working, etc. So my question is this, and I know you weren't here to listen to all of the evidence, but I think shouldn't industry be looking at the fact that nothing is 100% great and good and wondrous and safe? Everything that we use has a plus and a minus to it. There's not a single thing in this world that is all perfect. So shouldn't your companies and the cell phone companies and telecom people start looking to see if, in fact, they could mitigate some of the things by looking at what is the lowest possible frequencies that could be used, how you could create the kind of stuff we see in Europe where, you know, you power on, voice-activated powering on and powering off, so that the precautionary principle is there. Because I can give you an example of one industry that actually continued up until 10 years ago to say that there is no side effect from their use, and that's the tobacco industry, which had to be legislated and had to be forced long after there was compelling evidence of harm done by using cigarettes. I mean, it's the one thing we know that if used as requested, it will cause you to become sick. I think, so do you think that there is some way that telecoms could look at maybe having some sort of monograph with the use of your product that's easy to read from everyone that says, please don't keep this on your lap if you're present. Nobody's saying that it can cause, but just in case, here's what you do, and here's how we can do some warning for people to say, please take care. We don't believe, as you just said, you said you don't believe that there's hard evidence, but even in without hard evidence, we've always seen that it takes years sometimes, 50 years in tobacco. 20 years in acid rain to get that kind of evidence out there. So do you not think that there is work? We're told by some people that, in fact, telecom and wireless industries can, in fact, recommend a lower dosage use, a ways of preventing and having caution.
Australia does that. The Australian telecom industry does do that.
So would you see that something you would like your telecom companies to look at, given the evidence? And I mean, WHO has upgraded this now to a possible carcinogen. So is there something that, could we not get industry being forward-thinking and progressive in trying to look at how they prevent risks?
Well, thank you very much for your question. And the sector and the companies in Canada are very forthright. And we continue to support and encourage more scientific research if it is warranted and desired. And there has been research on this for a very long time. And it's easy to throw words around that really incite fear that are not based in anything at all. And in Canada, we rely on government. You mentioned about the health of Canadians. I think the people that really care and have the responsibility for the health of Canadians is the Canadian government. I'm sure you would agree with that as a former minister of the Government of Canada, that that is very important.
Okay.
So what I want to say is those standards that are set in Canada here are set by the Government of Canada. They're not set by the industry. And I think that's important to recognize. And the industry will continue to fully comply with those standards that are set. And we will support, and we do support research, but you have to appreciate, when research is supported by the sector or the industry, then people that don't agree with the research will simply say the research is biased because it has been funded or supported by the industry. And when the industry decides not to support research, then we're told, well, you should support research. The fact is, we do support research. We do fund independent research that we have no regard whatsoever on the research that is done. We take the evidence that is provided and is supported by the World Health Organization, and the standards that are set in Canada are set based on those international standards.
Thanks, Mr. Lord. I think you've... Yes?
We're over 5 minutes.
You're over 5 minutes? Okay,
yeah.
I'm so sorry.
Okay.
Thank you.
Now, I would ask the committee at this time, because we do know that the bells are going to go here in a minute or so. Ms. McLeod, she has a turn to go, and we need unanimous consent to allow her to have her five-minute round, and then that would put us at about 20 after, and then we'd still have quite a bit of time, 25 minutes to get to our votes. So I'd ask the committee for unanimous consent on that.
Great.
Is it okay? All right. All right. Ms. McLeod, go ahead.
Great, and thank you, Chair, and thank you to everyone for providing that support for the final round. I think it's always nice to be able to do a full round. You know, we had heard earlier from Anne-Marie Nicol, and she sort of indicated that the review of Safety Code 6 that was done, you know, could have been a much more comprehensive review. And so I thought that was kind of an interesting thing, because we certainly, this study is focused on sort of emerging evidence and health risks, but I was very, you know, interested in also getting a bit of an industry perspective, because as you point out, there's many people, I think there's not a meeting I go to in a rural community that doesn't have service, that they're not begging me for service, and they frequently talk about accidents on the highway. They talk about their ability to, you know, serve their set up small businesses. So I think absolutely we have to be very cognizant of what might be potential risks, but we also have to be aware of how critically important, you know, health and safety is. But I guess my one question, and I'll start with Mr. Lord, is there's a number of countries that have been referenced where they have actually created significant, I understand they've changed the standards, significantly lower standards. So what did the industry have to do to actually continue to provide the appropriate services but meet those new standards? So can you maybe walk me through how that can happen? I mean, to me, the idea that a baby monitor, we should be able to get baby monitors if people want to turn them on and off, I think, you know, I'm surprised that they're not available in Canada. It seems logical. So walk me through the impact of different standards in terms of the industry.
I cannot provide you that answer. I wish that I could, because I don't have the data or the information based on how the standards would be changed. I can tell you that the industry and the sector in Canada will comply to whatever changes that are brought by the government. And the fact that the government bases its regulations on science that is accepted worldwide, I think, is the right approach. And the sector will continue to provide that. And it's essential to ensure that Canadians do have access to that service. Everywhere I go in Canada, people ask us for more. Nobody asks us for less. And when we look at what's happening in Canada, Canadians are more connected than almost anyone around the world. We spend more time online than anyone in the world. We're among the heaviest users of mobile technology. And what we expect
And if we want to use numbers to scare people, well, in the next 5 years, data consumption in Canada will grow 700%. And what's happening is there's rollout of more networks and more devices throughout our communities to enable that growth that is supporting jobs, and businesses, healthcare, education, community safety, everywhere in our communities. And that's the part of the story that has to be told as well. And this can be done, and it is done, respecting the standards that are set based on science, and also applying, I'm sure that the folks from Health Canada have indicated to you, that they do apply the precautionary principle. It is included in the standards in Canada. And I've asked those questions, and they've told us that it is. And so we respect that.
I think the bells are going, and I only have 1 minute. So, I mean, I would presume in these countries where they have made changes, industry is accommodated, but you haven't had those conversations in terms of how industry has made the adjustments.
Well, if it's a question of not advertising devices to a certain group of the population, obviously that's easy to comply with. We'd have to look at each country to see how they've complied to the different regulations that they have. And we have had conversations, we have conversations at times with other groups in other industries and other countries, but to tell you specifically, I don't have that information. If you request that information, we can certainly find it, absolutely.
I think it would be
absolutely weird.
I think, as I say, the bells are ringing. I appreciate it. I just wanted to get those quick questions in, and thank you so much.
Thank you very much. That's going to conclude this meeting. I'd like to thank everybody for their respectful presentations and wish everybody a good evening. Meeting adjourned.